This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we'll raise a toast to the new year and test your whiskey science smarts. Do you know the chemistry behind that oaky vanilla flavor? Do you have the details on distillation? We'll talk about it. But first, I'm sure this sound makes a squirm, right? Ah, got it. But wait, my next guest would prefer that you think twice before swatting. Her new book is The Secret Life of Flies, and it's a love letter to the beautiful flies, the unusual flies, to the deadly and destructive, and yes, the disgusting members of the extended fly family. And the book is filled with surprises. I didn't know a whole lot of stuff about flies. For example, did you know that without a certain type of pollinating fly, you could kiss your chocolate bar goodbye? And yes, I did say pollinating fly. Flies do pollinate. Who knew that? Or that pesky mosquitoes are technically flies, too. And yes, even mosquitoes have a purpose in the world, contrary to what you might think. Erica McAllister is the author of The Secret Life of Flies. She's the curator of Diptera at the Natural History Museum in London. She joins us from the BBC. Welcome to Science Friday, Erica.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
We won't be taking your calls today, but check out the pictures of some of these incredible flies. You can see them at sciencefriday.com/flies. I had no idea that flies were so interesting. When did you discover your love affair with flies?
I've always loved insects, and I've generally been an outdoor, and I'm small and I fall over a lot. So I do spend a lot of time just observing the little things. But it really wasn't until my PhD and then afterwards I started getting to explore the flies. And then once you start, you realize there's just no going back. Because every time you think you've got them sussed, another one comes along and goes, ha-ha. And you're like, oh, really? So they're the most diverse, they're the funniest, they're the most intricate, they get everywhere, they do everything. There's just no point looking at anything else.
You talk about how important flies are for pollinating. I had no idea flies were pollinators.
No one does this. I mean, I think poor flies have got the worst press on the planet. Like, most people don't even realize what a fly is. They just try and kill them without thinking about it. And it's like, I don't go in your house and kill your puppies. Don't go out and kill the flies. And of the families described, we think half of them are pollinators. And unlike the bees don't like the cold. But the flies, they get everywhere. They're up the mountains. I've collected them at 5,000 meters. You know, they live in the Arctic, the Antarctic. They just get everywhere. They're so important as pollinators.
Yeah, let me remind our audience that they can check out pictures of some of these incredible flies at sciencefriday.com/flies. These aren't your standard houseflies that we're going to be talking about. But you do talk about your standard housefly.
Yeah, I mean, I feel sorry for the housefly. I mean, it's our fault for being quite revolting at times. It's latched onto us as an obvious species, and it's just followed us around the world. I mean, we get houseflies in the base camp of Everest now because we're just such filthy individuals leaving our trash everywhere. But the houseflies are one family of like 150 families. So just that body form that everyone thinks of is so, it's not usual in comparison to across the whole flies because they're all so weirdly different. It's just, you know.
Yeah. I didn't know that till I saw it. And you have wonderful color plates in the book showing the flies close up.
The whole thing is I'm describing things and everyone's like, no, it's not a fly. And I'm like, no, trust me, it is a fly. Even the flies without wings, which is like, is that not a walk? No, it's still a fly. And they are just amazing. They've just taken this body form and just gone with it. Some of them will rip their wings off midlife. The larvae are so different to the adults anyway. So the bit that we know is the flying around bit.
Yeah.
That can be a day. That's it. Wow. Most of their life cycle is the eating phase, which is quite a nice way of living your life.
Well, let's talk about in a little bit, but I first want to talk about this surprising fact I learned about chocolate, that flies are necessary for cacao pollination, but their habitat is also being destroyed.
Yeah, it's ironically, I hate chocolate. I just think it's revolting, which I think is why I'm me as a crusade for this fly is quite funny. But the adults, they have a specific habitat they want to breed in. And the female, she lays her larvae in aquatic environments. Now, our insatiable appetite for this revolting substance has caused us to knock down forests where they naturally occur in to build all these monocultures of chocolate. Now, the chocolate is pretty much like a panda. Pretty bad reproductive rates naturally anyway. So if you suddenly get rid of the flies, then their reproductive rates are going to be crashing completely down. So you have whole habitats, whole monocultures of this plant that's just not producing any fruit, any of the seeds.
So we could be losing our chocolate.
Yep. See, you don't look after the flies, you lose chocolate.
You wouldn't care about that though, as you
No,
say.
but I like the flies. The irony about these flies as well, no, is that it's from the family of biting midges. So the things that you hate when you go up north and to the wild wetlands of Alaska and things like that, and they plague you mercifully. These are the ones that the males are the pollinators.
Sometimes we call them no-see-ums.
No-see-ums, exactly. And they have to be no-see-ums because the cocoa plant is so complicated to get through to its reproductive parts. The fly is minute to be able to get through.
Wow. So the pollinating role really is highly unappreciated and unknown and
Yeah, I mean, we're beginning to look at it now. There's lots of studies in hoverflies looking at pollinators, but it's just we have never. So we see thousands of flies flying around plants, but no one takes attention because they're not the bees.
Yeah.
So we're probably massively underrated what's going on with them.
Now, I know that over the years we've talked about some very famous plants that when they bloom, they smell really like rotten meat. And I didn't really understand that reason. And you talk about it in the book, is that this is what attracts the flies.
Yeah, and I've now sampled off one of those plants, and I've sampled in a lot of bad habitats in my life, and they really do stink. And the thing is that they are attracting the flies that like corpses, rotting bodies, etc., the decomposing flies. And these things are getting those in there and they're trapping them inside them to cover them with pollen till they're ready to be released again and they will go and find another decomposing smelling flower. So, yeah.
Wow. I didn't realize until I read the book also that mosquitoes are part of the fly family.
I realised that I failed, or we have failed, is that my mum asked me this when she read the book. She was like, oh, I didn't realise mosquitoes are flies. And I was like, well, what did you think they were? And she was like, oh, I hadn't really thought about it. And I think that's my whole problem with flies, is that no one does think about it. I mean, we barely think of them as animals. And that's the whole thing. Yeah, I mean, crane flies, I hate the common name because it means three different things. But the flying daddy long legs, those are flies. All your midges are flies. There's hundreds of thousands of fly species out there.
So they really make up a large part of the animal kingdom.
Yes, off the top big four of insects, they're in there with the beetles, the butterflies, the bees and wasps, and the flies. So, and then when we start to properly look at them, thanks to new genetic ways of looking at our species, I think we're going to have a bit of a shock to actually realize how many species of flies out there.
Now, there are also lots of predatory
Yeah,
flies, too.
they're my babies. I love them. There's a group I absolutely adore, and they're the robber flies. And again, this is something we don't think about, is flies being venomous. So everyone thinks about the bees and the wasps and the ants, and it's like most of the predators in the flies and things like mosquitoes are actually injecting little bits of venom. And one of those groups is the robber flies. I think you call them assassin flies. And these are some of the top aerial predators out. In fact, there's a species in Southern California that has been shown to catch hummingbirds on the wing. Which I just think the idea of this like thug of a fly coming along. There's somebody watching this tiny, pretty little hummingbird. It's come along, it's caught the hummingbird, it's paralyzed it, and it's shredded it completely.
Wow.
It's quite fantastic.
This is one-on-one, or is it a whole group of flies?
No, one on one, and we've got them
Wow.
in the collection. They've caught dragonflies. They are such good aerial predators, and they can take. It's terrible. I shouldn't laugh. They can do it's quite bad damage to hives of bees, etc., because they're just thugs of flies.
Wow. And there are parasitic flies, too.
Yeah. There's some amazing endo and ectoparasites, and just the adaptation these flies have had to go through to live in the host that they do, or in their host. And it's quite, this time of year, everyone's going on about the reindeer and Santa, and it's like, well, there's the snot bots, so there's the little parasitic larva that lives down the nostrils of a reindeer, which isn't maybe so nice for the reindeer, but it's how this fly has evolved for its larvae to live there is quite fantastic.
And you make that point in the book, is that during the life of a fly, it's really the larvae that do most of the damage when they're, because they're very hungry.
Yeah, well, they have got no other function basically apart from to eat. So their organs are, they've got no sex organs, they've got no, basically no mechanism for movement. They are purely just there to eat. And some of them would survive like up to 5 years just eating.
And they might live inside another animal doing that?
Yeah, and there's a little parasitic group of flies called the Acroceraids, or the hunchback flies. And these live in the insides of spiders, in the abdomens of spiders. And if they get into a spider that's too immature, because the spider's going to again live up to 5 years, what they would do after, they would eat some of the less vital organs, and they basically just go to sleep for a couple of years and wake up when the spider is mature enough for them to eat the rest of it. It's
Wow.
fantastic.
Well, we've seen horror movies about insects crawling into people's heads and depositing eggs and whatever.
Yeah.
Is that possible with flies? Can they get inside people? And
Yeah, we've got the human bot fly. So I've not had this yet, but it's amazing. It's in Central and South America. They're really big and beautiful with massive eyes. They're quite clumsy flies and quite noisy flyers. So they figured out to catch either a horse fly or a mosquito, and then they lay their larvae or eggs on the underside of these mosquitoes. And so when the mosquito flies along, when she starts feeding on you, at that point the bot fly will drop into your skin and crawl through the hole. It's quite fantastic. And they will spend a couple of weeks just munching away underneath your skin so you can see them and hear them at night.
can you do anything about them?
Well, you can get rid of them,
Oh.
but I mean, they don't do any real
Oh, they
damage.
don't.
Well, it depends what you call real damage.
I
In
guess
the
so.
greater scale of things, it's not really a problem.
Erica McAllister, author of The Secret Life of Flies. We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more with her. So don't fly away. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday, and I'm Ira Flatow. We're taking a world tour through the fascinating realm of flies with my guest, Erica McAllister, author of The Secret Life of Flies. You mentioned in the book that you turned down the opportunity to actually have a fly travel through, was it your system?
I sadly haven't had a bot fly. One of my good friends has had one. And sadly for me, he wouldn't let it rear out. So after about a week or so, he was like, Erica, and swore at me a lot and said, if you don't remove this thing from my head, because it was on the head, it couldn't go down. It had to go along the cranium so you could really watch it develop. And he was like, no, this has to come out. And so we were in the jungle. There's nothing I can really do. So I've just stacked Vaseline over the top to suffocate him, because they breathe out of their anal spiracles. So they breathe out of their bum. So you can see these little spiracles waving around. So you suffocate them. And then I anaesthetized him with half a bottle of rum, which I thought was very generous. And then I slightly cut open his head to be able to extract the larvae out of it. But yeah, it's in the collection now, which is good.
And you enjoyed every second of it, I'm
Of
sure.
course I did. I'm a scientist. It was fascinating stuff.
Oh, there's so much to talk about. We're talking with Erica McAllister, author of The Secret Life of Flies. Let me tell you, this is one eye-opening book. Beautifully done, I must say, Dr. McAllister.
Thank you.
And you make the point that flies have been, we've ignored their biodiversity studies. We study all kinds of things. We don't study flies.
No, I mean, flies are very difficult. If you look at the age in the UK of the great Victorian hunters, and everyone goes on about the fondness for beetles and the amazing butterflies, and it's because actually they're quite easy to identify in many ways. Butterflies, you've got obvious patterns on the wings that are quite easy. Flies, tiny black flies is quite a common theme across all of them. And a lot of the identification is on genitalia dissections, which is quite fiddly And obviously, you need a lot of things like microscopes, etc. So a lot of people just ignored them. And then where they are the most biodiverse, their larval stage, they basically just resemble sleeping bags full of vegetable soup. There's very few features about them. So everyone just goes, ugh. And then just goes, yeah, there's a lot of fly larvae, and that's it. And that tells us nothing.
Wow, that's
And
incredible.
I know, I mean, imagine doing a habitat survey of birds and said, you're right, they're all pigeons. And that is basically what we're saying.
Let's talk about maggots. I mean, you're so fascinated with maggots, I know that.
I mean, it's the whole compartmentalization. Like we think about how clever the human is and are adapting to be these humans, and it's like, yeah, but we've gone. They go through four complete life stages, and each one is specifically adapted and it has adaptations within that as well. And it's just, I think they're utterly fascinating.
You talk about how necessary it is to have maggots for the disposal of waste, and also people are experimenting with them to as a feed for livestock. Tell us,
Yeah.
wow.
Well, I mean, the black soldier fly is the classic one here, which is it's an amazing. It's ubiquitous. It's now basically found all over the world, and we have maggot farms rearing up this little fly. And the thing about maggots is they're so protein rich, absolutely incredible. They're little packages of omega-3. They're just absolutely amazing things. And unlike a lot of the other protein that we get, they're not extravagant on water. And they don't use up so many of the other resources. And the thing that maggots don't do that cows do is maggots don't pass wind. So this is a massive impact on our environment. So we're now, instead of like trawling the seas and using all of these products to feed our livestock, we are actually using these maggots to feed the chickens, pigs, etc. And what's really cool about these maggots is that we're feeding them to the livestock, and then when the livestock defecate, we're feeding the feces back to the maggots. So there's this beautiful little circle, whereas they're not only providing food, is they're getting rid of waste. So basically everyone is benefiting, apart from probably the flies that are doing all the work and getting none of the benefit.
Do you think there is some, how shall I put it, human food someday down the road, eating maggots?
Well, without you realizing it, you're eating any already. There's a
Oh, yeah.
lot of, yeah. I mean, you just think about in chocolate, you're eating whole bits of insect, but that's another story. Yes, I think we will. I mean, obviously, we're going to not have maggots that have been fed off feces or dead bodies, but we are going to start producing that. Just the housefly larvae maggot is so protein rich and so available. And the idea of us like growing them in factories that are not on such a horrible substrate, so we can break them down. And the nice thing is now we're thinking about, because it's only the Western world that really has an issue with this, but because we're so fussy about what our food looks like, we're producing lots more insect flour. So you can start breaking it up and putting it into foods, so you're not realizing necessarily what you're eating, or it's not causing you to be so squeamish about
I have to go back to that chocolate comment you made about we're eating.
it.
That's for
Yeah.
another time. Hey, now is another time.
Okay. Well, it's just you're allowed. The governments all around the world allowed so many insects to be in your products. Apparently, the biggest one, and I love this, is frozen cauliflower. It has more insects in than anything else. So next time you have any frozen cauliflower, just have a little look, and you could probably find aphids and all sorts of things. And the same with chocolate, when they're making it, you get lots, and you can have whole parts of insect as well. I mean, I wouldn't know because I've never really. Last time I had chocolate was too many years ago for me to pay attention. But yeah, all of our products. You know, I go on field work in the middle of nowhere. So the rice I'm eating is probably completely covered with insects. It's not a problem.
Flies love alcoholic drinks, you write in your book.
Yes. Well, there's certain groups that are particularly known for them, and we are utilizing these for our own advantage. The fruit fly, Drosophila melanogaster, which has been our classic lab model for hundreds of years, and we've looked at the genetics and everything. But naturally, this fly has a tendency to eat rotten fruit. Rotten fruit makes alcohol. And it's quite fascinating. We're now looking at this fly, and we're getting this fly purposefully drunk. so we can look at the impact of alcohol on genes, because their genetic makeup is so similar to ours, it's very useful. Because apparently, ethically, we're not really meant to get humans drunk. So we're taking this advantage. And I'm very much like humans. When the males get drunk, they become more amorous, and but then their ability to carry out their functionality, as it were, becomes it decreases quite dramatically. So it's quite interesting what's going on.
So the fly mind is willing, but the flesh is weak.
Yeah, yes.
And of course, we know that flies, and you talk about this, feed on poop. We have a picture of a bunch of dung flies hitching a ride on a dung beetle.
Yes, I know. I love the fact that there's so many different types of fly associated with different types of dung. And, there's a wombat fly that eats wombat poo and things like that. And they are very important, because if you imagine, if it weren't for the flies getting rid of all this feces, as I say, we'd be swimming around in a quagmire of the stuff. And that is, I don't think, a
Yeah.
particularly pleasant thought for anyone.
Do you think people should go out and do what you do, and sit around a cow pie or a dung poo and have a watch about what's going on there?
Do you know what? Yes. I mean, maybe you don't have to start off on a dung pit. I could say start off on a bush, anything. But just have a watch. Because flies are also are very flirtatious, and there's a lot of mating rituals going on. So you can watch and observe the males dancing for the ladies. They're either throwing their legs up in the air. Some of them have got paddles, doing all these sorts of things. Some of them have got very pretty wings, and they're trying to dance, doing all these intricate behavioural traits. And that's an area that we've only just started looking at, because their life as adults is so short that often we never catch them as the adults. So definitely go out and start observing all these things that are going on.
In the book, you talk about flies with magical healing properties that go back centuries. We know
Yeah.
about that. Tell us about that.
Well, before the advent of penicillin, we were very concerned about what to do. And in fact, let's go back even further. Genghis Khan realized that there was something about these group of flies that was very useful. And as he went marauding across Asia, he always took a cartload of maggots, these calophorids. And basically, they are used for removing gangrenous flesh. And at the same time of removing this rotten, awful flesh, they're also secreting enzymes, which not only is stimulating the skin to bind properly again, it's reducing infection rates. So come forward to now, and like the last century, we used to have, I love the fact that in Yorkshire there was a maggotorium, where some guy, Arthur, used to go to the local zoo, and every time an elephant died, he would take the corpse off to the woods and let it decompose. So when these maggots got in, he was able to scrape them out, and he put them in their maggotorium, and these fine Victorian ladies would sit there inhaling the fumes, which I have to say that probably is quite smelly, but it reduced things like coughing, and we've now seen, we're looking at it, it does have an impact on TB and things like that. So nowadays, and again during the American Civil War, that was when we did so much advances, because they are realizing there were many doctors who were making notes, observing that when a maggot infestation in a wound actually cleared it, and there was less chance of getting gangrene. So today, with increased infections, penicillin resistance, increased infections, and also things like type 2 diabetes, the level of gangrene in hospitals, etc., has gone up dramatically. So we're now producing these maggot bags. And so we're once more utilizing these maggots. There are, again, there's massive factories producing these maggot bags to actually cover over our wounds for them to actually eat at this decomposing, this really nasty, rotten flesh.
You said they're sort of like tea bags. They put the maggots in the tea
Yeah.
in the bag, and they
Yeah,
can.
because apparently we don't like seeing maggots crawling around. So for sensitivity reasons, they now come in what looks like a tea bag. So you put them on your wound, and then you wrap your wound up, and then after, this is checked regularly by the nurse, and it's removed, and the maggots are sterile maggots anyway. They've come from a very clean environment, and then after they've done their bit, they get sadly destroyed. It's not like they're released to have like their freedom afterwards, but yeah. So the entire process is incredibly sterile and very, very beneficial.
There's a chapter on the so-called vegetarian flies in your book,
yes,
which sounds a lot better than the poop eaters or the dead body eaters. But you say they're actually some of the worst agricultural pests, yeah?
Yeah, well, this is it. People don't think about the vegetarians being really bad for the planet. I mean, they come in number two after the caterpillars. I mean, caterpillars are out there marauding, but everyone forgives them when they become butterflies. However, the flies don't have that luxury. They're hated as larvae and adults. So some of the biggest, most important problems come under the fruit flies and the vinegar flies. So these are like ones affecting olives and carrots and all of these crops that are so important to us in many ways.
In case you're just joining us, we're talking with Erica McAllister, author of The Secret Life of Flies. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Now, I can't let you go without, because we are a science program, to talk about how important flies are for scientific research.
Huge. You name it, they're there. They were the first animals into space. They are one of the most ubiquitous species. They occur in marine environments, terrestrial environments, arboreal, below ground. They live in the Arctic. They live in the Antarctic. They live in the great news recently about was finally figuring out how the diving flies of the Mono Lake in California. This has a pH of 10.
Oh.
You exactly. These flies are so amazingly adaptive. It is so important. We look at them, understand them, and we can use them to understand so many other things about the habitat, food security, vectors, the environment, modern medicine, everything. They are vital.
Let me see if I can conclude with talk about bat flies.
Oh, I love
really
bat
weird
flies.
Tell us what you love about them.
Well, they're just so weird. Now, there's quite a few families of bat flies. So which one do you want? Do you want the terrible hairy?
Go ahead. Just tell us about both of them.
Well, the terrible hairy fly was this enigma. You know, everyone goes on about endangered species. Well, the terrible hairy fly has been found from one location. And it was first discovered in the 1930s. They went back in the 1940s, and then it wasn't discovered again until a couple of years ago. So this is arguably one of the most endangered species on the planet, and yet it's not even in like IUCN. No one is worrying about it apart from a handful of dedicated fly specialists. And the thing about this fly is it lives on a crevice of a cave of a mountain with one colony of bats. And for years, we didn't know what was going on. Was it feeding on the bats? Was it feeding on their poo? What was going on? And now, thanks to this last collection that have gone back, they've been able to look at its gut contents and realise it's feeding on the feces. So it's actually living a very nice and very beneficial life for these bats as well. But the weirdest thing about it is it looks like a tiny spider that's lost a pair of legs. It's got tiny, tiny wings. It's orange. It's fluffy as anything. It's like a very long-legged teddy bear. It's an incredibly looking thing, and no one puts it as a fly.
What about the fly that actually gives birth to live young and...
Yeah,
lactating glands?
Yeah, these ones are found everywhere. These are amazing creatures. There's a whole super family, as we call it, Hippobosoidea, that contain these flies. So things like you hate, the tsetse flies, but also the incredible bat flies. And these are found all over the world. And these are amazing because the females give birth to live young. So we think this is like a prerogative of higher vertebrates. But some higher invertebrates obviously do this as well. And she has, internally, she has lactating glands on the inside. She has milk glands, and she raises her larvae inside. So the egg hatches internally in her, and then she feeds the larvae for up to a week before giving birth. And these larvae change in body size 100-fold. I mean, can you imagine? Yeah, think about a human with that sort of situation going. Most of her body is her offspring. It's quite fantastic.
Speaking of fantastic, so is the book The Secret Life of Flies by my guest Erica McAllister. It's an amazing book. I mean, it opened my eyes, you know, to the whole world of flies that I knew nothing about. And I'm sure our listeners will see the love affair that you're having with flies in that book. Thank you very much for being our guest and taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
Erica McAllister, as I say, author of The Secret Life of Flies, curator of Diptera at the Natural History Museum in London. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Now we're going to raise a glass and toast the holidays with our bourbon quiz. Earlier this year, we recorded the show at the Brown Theater in Louisville, Kentucky. No conversation there is complete without talking about bourbon. Master distiller Marianne Barnes tested our smarts about the spirit in a quiz. So we're going to take you to the stage, play along, and see how much you really know about bourbon. Trip to Kentucky would not be complete without talking about
bourbon.
Oh, you know your stuff here. And we're not talking rye or whiskey. We're talking about the corn-based barrel-aged bourbon. And there's a lot of science, actually, that goes into bourbon, from picking strains of yeast to formulating the right mash and the process of distillation and aging. They are all about getting the timing and the temperature right, and we're going to be talking all about this with my next guest, who is here to help us break down the science. Marianne Barnes is the master distiller at Castle & Key Distillery in Frankfurt. Welcome to Science Friday, Marianne.
Thank you so much, Ira.
Now, I understand that you have a degree in chemical engineering.
Yes, that's correct.
Does that make bourbon better, if you know how to, the chemistry about what's going on in there?
I definitely think people underestimate the amount of science that it takes to make a glass of bourbon.
And you're here to tell us about this. How did you get into this? How do you go from being a chemical engineer to being involved in making bourbon?
I really just kind of got lucky. I went to school because I thought I was going to do biodiesel, and then learned that there are a lot more fun things that you can make with corn.
And you are a master distiller, is that right?
That's correct.
And you make the recipes for the bourbon? You help make the recipes?
Oh, absolutely.
Wow. Okay. So what is the recipe, the basic recipe for making the bourbon?
Well, the regulation states that for bourbon, you have to be at least 51% corn. So the rest of your recipe can be made up of any cereal grain. Folks most often are using rye or wheat and barley.
Mm-hmm. And so when you work at Castle & Key, how do you make your bourbon distinctive from other bourbons? What's the secret chemistry there?
The secret chemistry of Castle & Key bourbon is all about history. So Castle & Key Distillery was built in 1887 by Colonel E.H. Taylor, and he had a very special way of making bourbon. In fact, we've based our recipe on a sample of bourbon of his that was made in 1917. So distilled pre-prohibition that had been preserved in the bottle, and we discovered it in the back of a dusty old liquor cabinet in a horse farm in the area, and actually used that, did an analysis on it, some GC, HPLC, decoded the recipe, found a genetically similar yeast strain, and that's how we based our recipes.
From a dusty old bottle in the back somewhere.
That's right.
We're going to get into the more details on our quiz, and you're going to stick around and help us do that. And all, you ready to play? You ready to play? Up for this, the audience? Play this film? Okay. We have a couple of teams. We have two brave teams of Louisville public radio fans who are going to ferment over our questions. Get it? Then they're going to distill the answers. Oh. And Annie Nero, who is the voice of Science Friday, you might have heard her during our shows, is helping us with the official scorekeeping. Hi, Annie.
Hello, Ira.
Ooh. Sound of God. Tell us what the prizes are.
The winners will get a Science Friday t-shirt, and from Louisville Public Media, you'll get a t-shirt and two tickets to the upcoming Moth Story Slam.
Ooh.
The stakes are high here, folks.
Oh. I want to play, but I can't. Okay, let's meet our teams. Over here on my right is the team we're calling Team Hot Toddy over here. Tell us about yourselves. How do you take your bourbon, for example?
I take my bourbon usually with sweet and sour mix, which is, I know, a terrible thing to say right now.
And your partner?
Hi, my name is Allison, and I like my bourbon on the rocks, please.
And our team on the left here, Team Old Fashioned, we're going to call that team. Welcome, Old Fashioned, to the competition. Tell us who you are and how you like your bourbon.
I am Heather. This is my husband. He's the sweetness. And I prefer my bourbon to be neat.
Mr. Sweetness?
Ironically, the Old Fashioned is my favorite bourbon drink.
All right, let's hear it for our teams. We're going to get ready for the competition. Marianne's going to judge the answers and tell us which one is the correct one and why it is the correct one. And the questions as we go along, they're going to get harder. But the good news is that you get more points. Let's start out with the first question. Okay, 1 point, worth 1 point. By regulation, as you told us before, corn makes up at least 51% of the grain recipe for bourbon. So here is your question. What is corn's most important contribution to the fermentation process? Is it A, enzymes, B, starch, C, flavor, or D, none of the above? What is the correct answer? You have 15 seconds to think about it. Go. Corn's most important contribution to the fermentation process. That old popular D up there. Everybody, some ways, well, 15 seconds are about up. There's Beulah the buzzer. Okay, what is the correct answer? Let me go to our friends in Hot Toddy. What's the correct answer?
I believe it's B, starch.
B, starch. Let's go over to Old Fashions.
We'll go with B.
B. Both said B.
That is correct.
Starch is the right answer. Why, tell us why that was the right answer.
Yeah, so when you think about the composition of a bourbon mash bill, it has to be at least 51% corn. And although it does contribute flavor, its most important contribution is the starch. It's got vastly more starch than the other two grains that you make it up with. So it's the workhorse of your grain recipe. This is what the enzymes are going to break down to produce sugars, which then the yeasts consume to make all of the beautiful bourbon.
Anybody making bourbon out of quinoa? I don't think
so. Oh, I've heard of it.
Yes. Give her an ID. I get 10%. Okay. Our official scorekeeper, Annie, what's the score?
Well, Team Hot Toddy has 1 point, and Team Old Fashioned also has 1 point.
Oh, it's pretty close. Okay. Ready for our next question. This question, thank you. This question, number two, is worth 2 points now because they're getting harder. We're going to talk about distillation. The distillation process separates ethanol, which is the good stuff that we want, from water by heating the liquid mixture. And this happens because, A, water is less dense than ethanol, B, water has a lower boiling point than ethanol, C, ethanol has a lower boiling point than water, or D, water and ethanol have similar boiling points. You have 15 seconds starting now. Why does that happen? You think amongst yourselves out there? Well, that seems like it took forever. Time's up. This time we're going to start with Old Fashioned team. What do you choose?
We're going to go with C.
C. You think ethanol's lower boiling point than water, and let's go over to Hot Toddies. What was your choice?
We're going to go with A.
What does the audience think? And the answer is?
C is the correct
C
answer.
C is the correct answer. Tell us why that's important.
So when you think about distillation and the process of distillation, it all has to do with the difference in those two temperatures. So at the bottom of the still, whether it's a pot still or a column still, that's where you get your hottest temperature at the heat source. So your alcohol and your water are both going to turn into a vapor. But as it moves up in the still, it's going to lose temperature. It's going to lose energy. The vapor, the alcohol will stay in a vapor phase, and the water will turn back into a liquid and head out of the still. So you're condensing your alcohol back into a liquid, and that's when it goes into the barrel.
So it sounds like you're starting out actually making beer and then converting it.
Absolutely.
Is that what's happened?
Yeah, so through the mashing process and fermentation, you turn it from, we call it mash, into distiller's beer, and then you strip off your alcohol during the distillation process.
Now, I know at Castle and Key, you're also making gin and vodka. What's the difference between that? Why do you do that?
So if you think about vodka and the way that it's distilled, we take it up to 190 proof plus. And at this point, you've taken all of the flavor out. So it's very pure. We have regulations in bourbon that it has to be distilled below 160, and that's to preserve a lot of the flavor. So that's the biggest difference.
Wow. We're going to move on. Annie, what's our score? Where are we now?
Team Hot Toddy has 1 point, while Team Old Fashioned has 3 points.
Team Old Fashioned is pulling ahead. We're going into the far turn. All right, question number three, worth, thank you. Worth 3 points now. Ethanol breaks down the charred barrel over time. What part of the wood contributes to the vanilla flavoring? Is it A, lignin, B, oak lactones, C, tannins, or D, McCormick's vanilla extract? Time starting now. Somebody was having fun with the questions here. Which one? All right, let's go over to Team Hot Toddy. What do you say?
We're going to go with C, tannins.
C, tannins. Old fashions, what do you think?
B.
Audience, what do you say?
B.
Everybody's all over the place. What's the right answer?
The correct answer is A.
Oh. Ooh, tell us why. Wow, everybody got that wrong.
Yeah.
We love that.
I'm gonna give you some real science here. So the wood lignin, if you think about it, it's like a ligament. So this is what holds the cellulose and the hemicellulose of the barrel together. So it's in the presence of heat and alcohol that you start to break down those lignins into different acids. Coniferal acid is the one that turns into coniferal aldehyde in the presence of oxygen. And then that turns into vanillin, which is the vanilla flavor.
What kind of wood is the barrel made out of?
So the barrel must be oak, and for bourbon, it has to be new charred oak. A lot of people think that it has to be white oak, but there's actually not a regulation there.
Oh, is that right?
That's right.
Wow. Can you age? Can you age the wood, or do you just literally charcoal it with a flame? And
the barrel making process is really interesting to me. We call them coopers, the people that make the barrel. They are artisans. The process that most people use, the tree to start with, has to be at least 40 years old.
So this, no kidding.
That's right. You get basically one barrel per tree. And you have to cut it in a very particular way so that the grains lock together when you assemble the barrel so that it doesn't leak. You often do what we call seasoning the wood. You leave it in the environment and it starts to break down some of these components, such as the tannins, and softens the wood and makes it a little more palatable. So seasoning.
I didn't realize all that stuff going into making.
Yeah.
Wow. Let me ask Annie, our scorekeeper, what's our score at this point?
Team Hot Toddy with 1, Team Old Fashioned with 3 points.
I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from Public Radio International. You're listening to our bourbon quiz, recorded at the Brown Theater in Louisville, Kentucky. Let's go back to the stage for our final question.
Okay, we're going into the last question here. There's a lot of science going on into making of bourbon, like we were just talking about it. What kind of science can you do with the bourbon? Question 4 is worth 4 points. Chance to make it up here. Which of these, this is a little more difficult, you have to watch this. Which of these is not a real study, which is a fake news about bourbon or whiskey? Choose the fake study. Is it A, what are the effects of ethanol and bourbon on maize learning in goldfish? B, can heated whiskey and other alcoholic beverages induce superconductivity in iron-based compounds? Is it C, can whiskey and ethanol be used to prevent wound infection in emergency settings? D, how does the microgravity of space affect the maturation process of bourbon? Remember, which of these is not a true study? The effects of bourbon maize on goldfish? Can whiskey induce superconductivity in iron? Can whiskey be used to prevent wound infection? How does the microgravity of space affect bourbon maturation? Which is a phony study. The other three are real. Time's up. Let's see what the teams came up with. Team Hot Toddy, tell us what you guessed. You don't agree with each other. Take a vote.
The goldfish is so ridiculous, but it's like so ridiculous that it's true. So let's go with D.
So you just changed it.
Yeah.
See, you went to D. Okay, D, what do you guys say?
I'm going to go with B.
B. Audience, what do you think?
B.
This correct answer is C. That is not a real study. You see it in the movies, right? They're always putting liquor out on wounds. Nah, it's not real. No one has ever studied to see if that one is real. You do experiments with bourbon. You never tried this one, right?
This is the one that I feel like is most likely, which is hilarious, right? Because you see people like with their bottle of whiskey in old westerns and that sort of thing.
Chew on this leather strap and we'll pour the whiskey on it in the meantime. Annie, what's our final score?
Well, the final score is Team Hot Toddy with 1 point and Team Old Fashioned with 3 points.
Team Old Fashioned. Wow. Thank you all. Thanks for playing the show. Thank the contestants.
That was our bourbon quiz with master distiller Marianne Barnes, recorded at the Brown Theater in Louisville, Kentucky. That's all the time we have for today and for the year. This is our last Sci-Fry broadcast of 2017. Thank you and Happy New Year. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. If you missed any part of this program or would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcast. Say hi to us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And you can hear us anytime on the Amazon Echo or Google Home. Every day now is Science Friday. Or email us. The address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. Send feedback and tell us what you'd like us to cover. In New York, I'm Ira Flatow.